Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations on a Friday. The great British press baron Lord Northcliffe came up with this great and memorable line that's as true today as it was 100 years ago. He said, "News is what somebody somewhere wants to suppress. All the rest is advertising." And here we are, several weeks after it was revealed that the Murdoch newspapers in the UK had hacked into the phone messages of a murdered teenager and the families of dead British soldiers. And depending which angle you're looking at this scandal from, you can see this as the nadir of modern journalism or a triumph of journalism. After all, it was good old-fashioned investigative reporting from The Guardian newspaper that brought it all to light. So I thought it would be a good time to bring you my conversation with John Nichols. John Nichols is the Washington correspondent for the influential American public affairs journal The Nation. John believes that the role of a journalist in a democracy is to stir things up, not to serve as a stenographer to power. I spoke to John Nichols during last year's federal election, and John had a lot to say about inane media coverage of inane set-piece campaign events. John's been observing the changes in America's media for some time. Newsrooms are shrinking, bureaus are closing, and the legions of PR flacks and lobbyists are swelling. And as revenue from newspaper advertising just dwindles away, the conglomerates who own them are looking for a way out the door. John's solution to this is truly radical and deeply shocking to Americans. He wants publicly funded media to fill the void in the public interest. I began by asking John where he got such a wild and crazy idea from.
I know that Australians have probably never pondered the concept as we sit here in the ABC studio. But the one of the things we do in the book, we did a big book on this called The Death and Life of American Journalism, very, very scholarly, very ponderous and thoughtful tome, which does make a fine holiday gift. And
so you can't do that on the ABC.
They don't sell it in Australia.
That's right. Already you're getting the downfalls of this. You're not allowed to plug stuff.
Well, it's okay because it's not here.
Okay.
And it's really about American journalism. But the interesting thing is that we actually look at countries around the world, and we kind of apply the American theory of publicly funded journalism. And we say, of course, in America, the theory is that if a dollar from the government goes into any kind of journalistic enterprise, you are immediately rocket to Pravda, right? It's Idi Amin's Uganda,
right?
A complete horror state. And then we think, maybe that's not the right comparison. Maybe we could compare to other sort of liberal democracies that, kind of are maybe a little more like maybe places that have rock music and cars, like Norway or even Australia. And we actually say that in the book. And in fact, the most highly subsidized public media, where journalism really does get a lot of resources from the government, according to both Freedom House, which is the international agency that studies press freedom, as well as The Economist magazine, are the places with the freest press. And so far from government subsidy creating propaganda or Stalin or something like that, all of the research tells you that it creates a better media, not a worse one.
You're talking about we'll come back to this a bit later, but you're talking about a country that really isn't into international benchmarking on a lot of things.
And you know what? That's great. Because if Australia international benchmarked according to the rest of the world, you'd actually be in a deep recession with 12% unemployment.
I was talking about the United States, actually.
No, sorry. The U.S. never – I apologize. No, we have actually benchmarked ourselves to the recession and done quite horribly.
I want to ask you, since you've written extensively about the media and its role in U.S. democracy, you're here during a really interesting time.
Yeah.
There is an election on. I'm sure you've noticed it. Mm-hmm. A lot of commentators are saying this is a pretty low grade election. Mm-hmm. I don't know, just your thoughts as an outsider looking on.
Well, first off, I'll tell you, any election that's got Mark Latham as a journalist is a fine election to me.
You're being ironic, surely.
I am. But I will tell you that irony is good around politics. Too often we lack that wonderful element. And I would say I was in the country for about 10 minutes when the Latham reality hit me. And my first reaction is, I have edited daily newspapers and I have had large staffs of reporters who I've assigned. And, it's very tough. You got to remember where to put a reporter. You don't have all the resources to do everything. And my first concept was that if I had a single reporter free, I would assign that person to stand next to Mark Latham through the rest of the campaign, because it's a pretty good bet something crazy is going to happen right there. But I think the Australian election is actually I guess a foreigner, I can't say that it's lame.
Yes, you can.
It would be a little bit.
Well, I'm asking you for that observation.
It's rude to say that, but I have not been blown away by either candidate. Tony Abbott looks a little bit like a flight attendant. He's got that. He's very trim and very good shape with a nice close haircut. And I was trying to think of your prime minister, who she reminds me of, and she sort of reminds me of your sister's unmarried friend. Who sometimes comes for the holiday dinners and things like that. And you've gotten to know really well over the years, and you really like her, but you're sort of wondering whether what's going to happen with her.
How about the coverage of the election? The media coverage, that's very memorable. The coverage is kind of interesting. Even on ABC News last night, being reported that the Prime Minister was attempting to launch her broadband policy, but was blown out of the water by the major distraction of Mark Latham fronting Tony Abbott. Well, who's being distracted here? Why not be distracted? We were trying to cover this for you, but we got distracted by a former Labor leader fronting Tony Abbott. Well, and that's their fault.
Absolutely. Look, I have worked in newsrooms for a long, long time, and I think I know most of our tricks, right? Our best trick is if some media outlet does something incredibly irresponsible, outs somebody's sexuality or publishes something that's completely awful. As the editor of the responsible publication, I assign a reporter to write about public reaction to that so I can get the whole thing into my publication in some sort of cleaned up, framed out way. It's clear 60 Minutes, your 60 Minutes program, has played a wild game here. They want to get really big ratings, and so they've thrown this guy out and said, go just be a crazy man, And that is in some senses, a commercial or a ratings-driven gambit. And the rest of the media is, frankly, it's essentially operating as the PR department for 60 Minutes. It's building it up to such a point that you and everyone else is going to have to watch what he finally comes up with. And that's fine. I don't even think that's a horrible thing. But when what used to be the tagline story at the end of a half-hour newscast, the kind of thing you put on as the funny element at the end.
Yeah, the panda giving birth at the Mizzou.
That, exactly. The monkey with the three eyes, right?
Chimps on bikes, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. I have covered elephant birthday parties as a young reporter, so I know about these stories. But that's the one you usually put at the end of the broadcast, right, after the weather. When that becomes the lead of your broadcast, what you're doing is you are saying to the people, what's happening here doesn't much matter. Yes, we're going to decide the kind of fate of the country, whether we go to war, whether your children, might be sent off to die someplace, whether you'll be taxed at a level that doesn't allow you to do things, whether your environment will be protected or destroyed. All these things are going to be decided. But they don't really matter as much as if some, slightly unemployed guy touches the prime minister. In Mark Latham. That's something that we do a lot as journalists. And then we bemoan the fact that the people aren't interested in serious issues. Well, if we tell them up front that the important stuff doesn't matter as much as what this guy's doing, we are teaching people to not take it seriously. It is a diminution of the journalist's role.
Press gallery politicians will punish any candidate for not sticking to the script. for splitting from their leader or minute policy differences, mm-hmm. and then bemoan the fact that candidates are so vanilla these days. They never tell us what they think. They won't ever give us a straight answer. Mm-hmm. Ah, your leader said something a bit different. You're mm-hmm. in trouble now.
Mm-hmm. I came out of rock and roll. I mean, I've been practicing journalism since I was a kid, but I was in rock bands as well, which is, you know, I mean, that's ultimately, if you fail as a rock and roller, you either become a journalist or, I don't know, radio host. and something really tragic.
Comedy for me.
Fail as a comedian, it's even worse. Mm. But, you know, there's always this phenomenon in the music press where when you're kind of coming up as a band, they write really, wow, there's this incredibly innovative band. They're so different. They're so interesting. We love them. And then once you make it, then they're like, what a load of crap this is. You know, these guys, they sound like, oh, my gosh, that's, you know, it's so predictable. It's so awful. And so it's sort of like they bring you up and they like you. If you're sort of if you're the backbencher who's a little bit of an outsider, but it's got a good quote and good personality, then the press gallery adores you. And they will ride you right up. But the second that you're actually at the cusp of power, then all the things we used to celebrate, you know, that you're an independent thinker, that you're an innovative idealist or whatever, all the things that we used to like, say, oh, we don't trust that kind of person with power. No. If we're going to let you, again, decide whether we go to war or something like that, you've got to be the most boring status quo establishment person in the room. And we will actually vet the process to push away. Now, we saw it in America. I'll give you a classic example. In 2004, George Bush, I think that arguably Mark Latham could have beat George Bush, should have been able to beat George Bush. You know, a trained orangutan should have been able to beat George Bush. He had really done a lot of stuff that offended a lot of Americans. And so the Democrats had a candidate who was essentially saying that in Howard Dean. He was, you know, the doctor, former governor, very, you know, kind of aggressive, fun, ready to take it to Bush. And we know now in hindsight that Karl Rove, Bush's political director, was terrified of Howard Dean, had whole files on, you know, because they really thought, oh my gosh, if the Democrats nominate somebody who goes hard at Bush, that's going to be very damaging, very dangerous. Well, during the primary process, all of the journalists at a certain point after Dean started to really rise politically started writing, says, is he too crazy to be president? Now, the guy had been governor of Vermont, our most boring state, for 8, 10, 12 years. I mean, he was a dull guy. He was just saying aggressive things. But we literally had a cover of one of our national magazines, Newsweek, which you've had here. Is Dean too crazy to be president? And we journalists kind of, you know, said, oh, this guy's a little too interesting. He's saying things too bluntly. So we're going to chop him off and make way for John Kerry, who is actually the most stilted politician in the history, the only guy who could look more unreal than Bush. And so we do – I would argue we journalists actually, A, in trying to vet the process, we're the most militant defenders of the status quo. And in doing that, we harm not only democracy, because we ought to welcome more divergent views and a real stirred up thing. That's how countries might move forward.
Yeah, contest of ideas.
Yeah. But we also harm ourselves, because we end up, after we've chopped, you know, the head off every interesting politician, we end up usually with a contest between the two dullest people in the country. And then we're like, well, this is a really dull race. Bummer. Journalism ought to think a lot more about its role in democracy. And believe me, I meet journalists who do. I was at an event in Brisbane last night with some wonderful young journalists from The Australian and from local publications who are just passionate and really committed. And I was very, very impressed. So I know that there are journalists who are thinking a lot. But I think that sort of press gallery, top of the line group of folks, yeah, every once in a while we ought to pull the brake and send them out to the outback, make them walk around for, you know, a couple of days on their own, and think about the role that they play in a democratic state, because their job is more important than that of any of the politicians, right? At the end of the day.
I want to quote a friend and colleague of yours, Jay Rosen from NYU, who was on the Late Line last night with mm-hmm. Lee Sales. And he was talking about what he calls horse race journalism. It happens during campaigns, he says. There's a campaign template for election coverage. Mm-hmm. It's quite reusable. You can bring it out like a kind of artificial Christmas tree every year, open up the box, assemble it, and the same thing works every year. And he said it's a helpful thing for journalists, this template, because it's reusable, it makes you sound like a player, and it requires almost no knowledge. It's mm-hmm. coverage based on who will win, rather than about the issues the country needs to resolve. This is sounding like something you'd be in agreement with.
Passionately. In fact, I think Jay is one of our great thinkers about journalism. Jay's not a journalist. He's an observer of journalism. And in a way, I want our working journalists to kind of get a little bit of Jay in their head, you know, kind of step back now and again and look at what we do, look at the impact that it has on democracy. The horse race thing is exactly what you're suggesting. The incredible thing is, and I guarantee this is true, you could take any top political journalist in the United States or any top political journalist in Australia, and you could transplant them to the other country. Just flip them. And you'd say, oh, well, that's impossible. They don't have the knowledge of our great history and our dynamics and our unique political culture. Well, excuse me. You take any Australian journalist, put them in the United States, and if all they – the first thing they say is, what do the polls show, right?
Yeah.
So the poll says, oh, this guy's ahead. So they say, okay, you know, tell me about a couple little bits, two or three bits of information. You know, is this guy funny or is he, you know, loose? Is she, you know, charming or is she kind of uptight? Okay, got it. Put me on air. I'm ready to go. I can talk for an hour about this process.
Because that's what a lot of journalists do. Unfortunately, they do spend a lot of time. The one thing they do know is journalism.
Yeah.
And so they'll cover the coverage.
Oh, and that's the, you know, with all due respect, that's the worst thing in the world. You know what I mean? Of course, the reason you go into journalism is because you're a horrible gossip, right? That's the truth, right? You want to be the first person to know something and tell other people things. That's why you go into it, of course. We know that. We don't like the term gossip. It seems a little unprofessional, but that's what we are. And so the worst part about it, though, is that because political journalists are covering a rather precise endeavor, the people that they can have the best conversations with are other political journalists, and they can observe how others do it, and that's really interesting to them. But I actually believe that – here's one of the things that I would do politically. I would one day get rid of the press bus, get rid of the press plane, and say, you got to figure out how to keep up with the politician. Get your own car. Come behind. You know, come your own way. Arrive there. Instead of, you know, like coming into the bubble and following the politician all along.
Yeah, of course, maybe you're aware by now that that's how campaigns work in Australia. The traveling entourage
Same
that goes
the
with the leaders.
Yeah.
They wake up in a hotel room in somewhere.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of paper that's slipped under the door that says, today the bus will be leaving for an unknown destination at this time. You'll get on the bus and then you're taken to somewhere.
Yeah.
And the leader will be there. There'll be some pictures set up nicely. They won't know where they're going on any given day. Is it the same in the United States?
Yes, very much the same. In fact, I spent a year covering Bill Clinton in 1992, a long time ago, and as a young reporter. And it was the only thing they would tell you the night before is when you had to be in the lobby, right? Then you'd go to sleep. And, of course, Clinton slept for an hour every night. It was just – the man was insane.
Kevin Rudd was like that,
and
too.
And who knows who he was for that hour. So the bottom line is that it was a very short period of sleep, and you were kind of like exhausted. But in that time, they would slip a piece of paper under the door that would tell you where you were going. But you –
The Moonies do that to indoctrinate people, don't they?
Yeah, they don't let you sleep. But the nice thing about the Clinton thing was that they also had – they had these – the Clinton campaign plane, they had these lovely young women. I think it went over very, very well, who when you got on the plane, no matter what time, 4 in the morning, midnight, would be there with these large baskets, one of them filled with chocolate bars and the other one filled with Coca-Cola right, cans. And you would – you know, so you'd get on the plane. You're hungry. You're desperate, right? You know, so you grab your chocolate and your Coke. And so you're – it's like – it would be like having a group of you know, like sugared up 4-year-olds, you know. And we're all like, oh, boy, what did he do today? What did he do today? Oh, he gave the same speech as yesterday. Okay. You know. And what I'm saying here, trying to say inarticulately as I may, is that the best thing that could happen to journalism is if we delinked it from politics. You know, we delinked it from the political operation, and we said, by law, there can't be a campaign bus. There can't be a campaign plane. The campaigns can announce where they're going to be the next day, and the journalists can go find their way out there. And you know what I mean? But the idea of creating this community around a candidate and then flying that community back and forth, you become very reliant on the people that are organizing it. And I'll give you a very good example. After Clinton was elected in 92 in the States, we're down in Little Rock, and we had the big – you know, he won, right? And we all covered it, and we all go back to our hotels. The next morning, he was president of the United States. No piece of paper came under our doors. We did not know what to do. And I remember a friend of mine who was a correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, one of our great, great newspapers, at the first press conference afterwards, George Stephanopoulos, who was Clinton's campaign spokesman, this guy, after about halfway through there, saying, you know, well, what are you going to do with the nuclear option, you know, and what are you going to do about the economy? Like the third question, the guy from the Tribune goes, George, this campaign is completely falling apart. I don't know. I didn't get a piece of paper this morning. I don't know what we're doing. What are we going to do this afternoon?
And
where are we having dinner?
And they go after them for the lack of professionalism at that point.
Yeah, your campaign's falling apart. How are you going to govern? Yeah. You didn't even give me a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Well, all I'm saying is that's a very unhealthy – that is a very unhealthy relationship. It's a dysfunctional relationship.
You're drinking the Kool-Aid. My guest in conversation is American political journalist John Nichols. One of the phenomena in this campaign has been the ABC program Q&A, hosted by Tony Jones. And it's a very interesting thing. It's very watchable. It's rating very well. It's the big number one trending topic on whatever in Twitter or whatever on every time it's on. And it seems to me, watching that as an outsider, as a non-journalist, is that the press gallery can't are interested in gotcha trap questions, trying to get them to contradict themselves. That's failed. And now what has required is the journalist must outsource questions to the general public. And then they get better quality questions and you get better quality answers. How would you see it that way?
Well, we don't actually get better quality questions from the public.
I think we do in this campaign.
I love the public.
I think we do in this campaign.
Well, you may in this campaign. Mm. But I want to suggest to you, it's not that you get better quality questions from the public. What you get is questions. Right, you actually get actual questions from somebody who's interested in finding out what the candidate has to say, as opposed to most of what politicians get from working journalists, from the top journalists. There's never an issue. There's never ideology. Never this notion of explain your broadband plan to me. With all due respect, I watched that thing where Tony Abbott was asked to explain his broadband plan. The guy who was asking the question was reading it from a piece of paper. He didn't know what. He was like, well, I think peak speed means, you know. I mean, come on. The journalist doesn't know. This is absurdity. And asking a journalist to actually, you know, like be up to speed on issues these days is a pretty big ask. So people ask real questions. They ask honest questions. And it's not that they're better. It's just that they're real. And journalists, again, should pause and take a look at this phenomenon and say, you know, they're always like, wow, how did that 12-year-old kid from, Perth figure out to ask such a great, you know, just completely knock them down, amazing, put the politician on the spot question. I've been practicing journalism for 40 years. I just couldn't do that. Well, you know, with all due respect, you probably coulda, but it would require you to do two things that journalists don't like to do. One, appear like a real person who might not know the answer to every question, like actually ask a question looking for an answer rather than already knowing what's going to be said and just trying to get your quote to fit into your story. And two, to be genuinely interested. And one of the worst things about the theory that journalists should be unbiased, you know, they say, oh, we've got to be pure. We can't care about this. Is that many journalists have actually sort of brought into themselves this style that I really don't care. It doesn't matter to me. I'm just an observer here. I'm trying to gather some information, but I don't care who wins. I don't care what happens. Well, at the end of the day, you are then completely delinked from the great mass of people who do care.
Let me put the countervailing argument to that there's too much ideology in American news coverage at the moment. And what that really means is that you have reporters, journalists, then beholden to a kind of a whole bunch of abstractions and less care, if you like, about the facts that are in front of them.
It's an extremely good question, and it gets to something that Australia should avoid. Sometimes people misinterpret what's happened in the United States. You refer to these people as journalists. Most of what you're talking about are hosts of cable television programs, sometimes even radio programs, who come on and instead of going out and gathering information or trying to report a story, they come on and say, here's what I was thinking today. You know, I'm really mad at Bush or I'm really mad at Obama, who I think was born in Indonesia and is a Manchurian candidate and the most dangerous thing, you know. And so they just sort of rant. And then they bring on, after about an opening rant, they bring on somebody to rant with them, you know, and then another guest who will rant with them. But there's no journalism in this. I do these shows. I can, and I'm quite good at ranting. But Let me tell you, I do these shows. And in doing the book on American journalism that we did, each time I did a show over the last couple of years, I would ask the booker, the person who got me on, I'd say, you know, how many journalists does your show employ? And they always laugh. They're like, journalists? No. You know, we have a host. We have bookers. People come on. That's what we do. And so we've pushed journalism, real journalism, the idea of going out and, you know, digging up a story, talking to real people, that's been pushed to the side. Yet in America, we call this sort of Potemkin journalism, you know, we say, oh, that's journalism. It's not. There's no journalism in it at all. It's bloviating. It's not even what you would think of as, you know, like I'm sitting here with you and I'm going to let the listeners in on the studio here. You actually like have written out like four pages of questions and notes and you've prepared and thought about it. I guarantee you, when I go on these shows in the States, if I saw somebody with four pages of notes, I would be, you know, my head would explode. It's unbelievable because you come on for about 2 minutes and they say, and literally the host will say to you, don't you think Obama's a crook? And you go, well, I'm not sure. Thank you. But you get invited again if when they say, don't you think Obama's a crook? You say, yeah, just like Jesse James. You know, you get some sort of good soundbite and then you get to stay.
You know? Just like Jesse James, my guest is a radical. Not a radical.
I'm a very radical. I think that nobody who practices journalism, I don't care whether you're a radical on the right or the left, but I think the wonderful term radical. I love the term because a radical is something, it's an element that is, it can't quite be controlled, and journalists shouldn't be controlled.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
My guest in conversation today is American political journalist John Nichols. He's the Washington correspondent for the US public affairs journal The Nation. He's the author of a book called The Death and Life of American Journalism, co-author of that. Mm-hmm. He sees the American media in crisis, but he's got some solutions. We'll come to those in just a moment. You were talking, John, about the situation where news is replaced by opinion, ranting. Mm-hmm. That's really, there's not much thought in journalism that goes into it. Can you see that coming to Australia?
Absolutely. I think it will come to Australia. It's a brilliant business model because actually sending journalists out places costs quite a bit of money. You know, if you were to say, oh, well, we've got Australian troops in Afghanistan, we're kind of occupying a country, maybe we should pay attention to that, right? So you got to send that costs a lot of money to send a journalist up there. But even sending a journalist out to the middle of the country to write about some issue involving indigenous peoples and things like that, it's going to cost money. It's a lot cheaper to just put somebody in a studio who sort of like maybe looks on the internet, sees what folks are talking about that day, and then comes in for an hour and rants and raves and, you know, says, oh, my gosh, immigrants, I'm really scared of them. And what do you think? Well, here's what I fear will happen in Australia. It has happened in other countries. It's coming to Britain right now. It's really kind of integrating in to some extent. And it's certainly happened some in Canada. This American model is such a successful business model that when commercial media outlets start to not get sufficient level of advertising. And remember, a lot of advertising is fleeing to the web and going other places. They got to look for really cheap ways to fill 24 hours. Right now, you've got Sky here doing a 24-hour news show, which I watch. I actually think it's pretty high quality. I'm genuinely quite impressed. If it was in America, it would be the best broadcast journalism or best cable journalism in America. But then you've also got the ABC, which is this very trusted brand. Now, ABC has just brought its 24-hour newscast on, right? I'm going to bet you that within a year or so, ABC's 24-hour newscast will be beating Sky. Now, remember, this is only a small portion of the audience, but that portion that's going for the 24-hour news. And Sky's going to be under pressure. Oh, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? How are we going to make the money? How are we going to make this work? And somebody's going to say, you know what you could do? Instead of having all these, you know, like journalists run around covering every press conference, why don't you put a host on? You could find some former comedian or something and, you know, somebody entertaining and put him on air and let him rant about something, you know. And because this is the interesting dynamic. When somebody is angry and passionate, when they're ranting, it creates the fantasy for people that they're being informed. Because if the host has gotten all excited, then it must be important, right? It must be real. And if they bring a guest on and the guest is all excited, then that must make it more real. If the guest sort of disagrees with the host and the host says, hold it, I'm not going to let you get away with that. And then you're like, wow, I've just seen journalism or something like it. And so you fill the hour. It seems very real. It seems very informative. And yet you've not sent a single journalist out to cover anything. You haven't gathered information. You haven't, heaven forbid, you haven't gone and actually found somebody who's in a tough situation that's got a tough story to tell that requires, you know, weeks of investigation. You've just had an hour of ranting, but you've filled the void. And I always reference my good friend Joe Stalin on this. Joe Stalin was once asked about the famine in the Ukraine. And he said, what are these people going to do? There's no food. And he says, is the grass still growing? And the person said, yeah. He said, yeah. And he said, well, why don't you let them eat grass? I know it doesn't sustain them, but it'll fill the stomach, right? Well, I think that these kind of ranting shows are the equivalent of that. It sort of fills the stomach with a sense that you've had journalism, but it's not a full meal and certainly not a healthy meal.
There's another thing that the ABC does a lot, which and commercial networks do a lot in this country, which is much milder than the kind of thing you're talking about, which mm-hmm. is to bring someone who's party hacks from both sides
of politics.
Oh,
the worst thing possible. Yeah.
And they once says, well, I think this and the other thing. And it's not ranting. It's pretty reasonable, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But they're barrackers, pretty much, for either side of politics. There was a show in the United States on CNN called Crossfire, yep. which was like this. And it was co-hosted by a guy who used to work for Bill Clinton, Paul Begala, and Tucker Carlson, a young man who wore a bow tie.
An adult who wore a bow tie.
a member of the Republican Party. Jon Stewart from The Daily Show mm-hmm. went on mm-hmm. some years ago as mm-hmm. their guest and destroyed their show.
I made a special effort to come on the show today because I have privately amongst my friends and also in occasional newspapers and television shows mentioned this show as being bad.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that that wasn't fair, and I should come here and tell you that I don't. It's not so much that it's bad as it's hurting America. So I wanted to
but
come here
defense,
today
let me,
and say...
Wait.
No, just,
let me,
here, here, right. Here's just what I wanted to tell you guys.
Yeah.
Stop. See, the thing is, we need your help. Right now, you're helping the politicians and the corporations, and we're left out
well,
there to mow our lawns.
You just said we're too rough on them when they make mistakes.
No, you're not too rough on them. You are part of their strategies. Your partisan, what do you call it, hacks.
Wait, John, wait, like, let me tell you something valuable that I think we do that I'd like to see you
something
do.
Something valuable?
Do. Yeah, no, it's
I would
nice
like
when,
to, I would
when
like
politicians,
to hear it.
When, and I'll tell you, when politicians come on,
yeah.
it's nice to get them to try and answer the question. And mm-hmm. in order to do that, we try and ask them pointed questions. I want to contrast our questions with some questions you asked John Kerry.
If you want to compare your show to a comedy show, you're more than welcome to. This, you're doing theater. When you should be doing debate, which would be great.
No, it's not honest.
What you do is not honest. What you do is partisan hackery. And I'll tell you why I know.
You have John Kerry on your show, and you sniff his throne, and you're accusing us of partisan hackery?
Absolutely.
You've got to be kidding, man.
You're on CNN. The show that leads into me is puppets making crank phone calls. What is wrong with you?
Well, I'm just saying...
That's Jon Stewart from The Daily Show appearing on the former CNN show Crossfire, which was cancelled.
Shortly thereafter. Yeah, which is in my view, we should just take Jon Stewart and put him on each show one after another to take it down. It may take a couple weeks, but I think we can completely get rid of it.
I feel we need to come back and defend journalism again now, don't we? I mean, journalism.
But remember, let us be clear here. Tucker Carlson and Paul Begala in that setting were not – I mean, they're not journalists. They were personalities put on a show with a job to be the Republican guy and the Democratic guy. Now, right off the bat, that's unhealthy because – and you and I have talked off air about this. I'm a huge fan of ideology. I like people who really believe things and on principle argue them. But a Republican and a Democrat, or I would suggest here a coalition representative and an ALP rep, they're not there because they believe things, right? If the ALP line – was that for this day was that we are going to go to a complete free market economy and shut down the national healthcare system. The ALP representative who came on that show would say, you know, the worst thing that ever happened to this country was socialism, right? And if the coalition decided that, no, the coalition's principle is that we have to nationalize all of the mines in the country and, you know, completely make them state-run businesses, the coalition person would come on and say, you know, we misjudged socialism. It was a really good idea. You could reverse the entire thing because that's what they're paid to do. And when you put someone who is paid to trumpet the party line, no matter what the line is, even if it's completely opposite what the party has traditionally said, that it's worse than theater. That insults theater because actors, right? Actors actually try to, you know, bring something to a role.
They're a lot better looking than Tucker Carlson and Paul Begala, too.
Yeah, don't bring anything to the role. They just do the line. It's terrible.
So much journalism in electronic media feeds off print journalism.
Yes, yeah.
And that's still the case. Nonetheless, print journalism is shrinking, as you've chronicled in your book. Mm-hmm. Bureaus are closing everywhere. Mm-hmm. Whole newspapers are shutting down. Metropolitan markets are not being served by newspapers, print newspapers, mm-hmm. anymore. So we're in a situation where there's more and more media feeding off less and less print. What do they fill that hole with?
Well, it's a really – again, it's this thing of ranting, right? And the painful thing is that they will rant day after day after day about a faux issue. Trivia becomes really powerful. And to give you a good example of where I think it's actually even beginning to happen a little in Australia, the other day I was on the Drum, the TV show. And before they brought me on to, you know, talk about, you know, whatever silly thing I was going to talk about, the three guests who were very, very smart people and weren't hacks. I mean, they really are, you know, one of them was actually technically a hack, but two of them kind of weren't. And they were all like talking about this stuff. But they literally were having this lengthy discussion about transportation in West Sydney. Right? You know, how does the train get to West Sydney?
A rail corridor that's been promised for
forever,
more than a decade,
I understand,
and never been built.
You know, with all due respect, this is a national television program. Right? In the midst of an election where you're going to choose a government that is involved in wars, right? And occupying foreign countries and is talking about a national broadband system, which really will define your telecommunications and your communications for the 21st century. And they're devoting substantial amounts of time to what's really like a local issue. I know federal money comes in and it's okay to reference it, but this is trivia being raised up to a level that it, you know, we can devote a whole show to this. And the worst thing I'm seeing in Australia right now of this sort of pattern is that the parties decide this is the day we're going to talk about, you know, whether you should water your lawn. And okay, wall to wall. Everybody's going to discuss and they have thoughtful commentary. Well, you know, if you water your lawn too much, you know, it might get soggy. And that's letting the politicians guide the entire discussion and letting them take it to places. Why were you discussing rail corridor in West Sydney? I'll tell you exactly why. Because the ALP government in New South Wales is a little unpopular in that region, and so the federal government's trying to come in and kind of backstop some things and get some votes. So that entire discussion is sort of shoring up a political strategy of a party, not talking about what really matters.
It's servicing the people of Western Sydney, indeed. What is the ratio these days of PR people to journalists in America? I really have no idea how it's not good here, I know, but what's it like in the United States?
Well, I'll give you a good example. This is actually something that wasn't known until we did our book. And and it wasn't that hard. I don't claim that we're really smart. We took the number of journalists and we compared it to the number of PR people and did a little bit of research. Didn't take all that long to do, but nobody had done it. And then we took it across the past. 1960, when John Kennedy was elected president of the United States, there was one PR person for every one journalist in America. In 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected president, there was 1.2 PR people for every one journalist in America. Today, there are 4 public relations people for every one journalist. And the problem is that then we looked at some studies from cities around the country. And there's a Pew Center, which does a lot of – it's not Pew like it stinks. It's Pew like, you know –
P-U-G-H.
Anyway, they just spell it nice. It's P-E-W, but it's – they're really nice people and they do a lot of good research. And so they study different communities. And they studied communities across the country, particularly Baltimore, Maryland. And they said, how is stories generated? How do all the stories in the news come? And they quantified in Baltimore during the period of their study that 86% of the stories began in some form of PR. In the newspaper, TV, radio, this is 86% of the stories. Only 14% coming from a journalist saying, well, I'm going to go out and dig something up. And so what's happened in America as our newspapers have really declined. We've seen we had 140 newspapers in the U.S. close last year. We also have been, over the last 2 years, laying off newspaper employees at a rate of about 1,500 a month. We've lost 30,000 newspaper employees in the last 2 years. In the last 8 to 10 years, we've lost 19,000 radio personalities. This is a result of a consolidation of our media and also a lot of advertising going to other places. These are changes driven by economy to some extent and also a lot of other factors. Bottom line, though, is as journalism has declined, as we have fewer and fewer people practicing the traditional art of journalism, PR has filled the void. It's not like there's no information. There's just packaged and managed information. And this is the thing that citizens ought to fear. It is, you can hate journalists. That's fine. We probably do a lot of things that merit hate. And you can certainly complain about how the ABC runs or how the Australian runs or something like that. But I think the best way to think about it is to go and rent a Woody Allen film, Annie Hall. In the middle of the film, Woody's talking about a broken relationship, and he's trying to explain it to somebody. And he refers to two old women sitting at a cafeteria. And the one woman says, "The food here is awful." And the other woman says, "It's the most awful. It's terrible. It's inedible." And then the first woman says, "Yeah, and such small portions." And that's about where we're ending up with the journalism. You can complain about it all you want, but if there isn't journalism, you're going to have public relations. And public relations is going to manage our discussions. And do you know who wins when public relations manages the discussion? Power.
Power. It will win. Now, the conventional wisdom at the moment, John, is that newspapers are in decline because advertising has dried up, because the internet's come along and people are sourcing their news from the internet, not buying, handing over money for the newspaper. And you say that's wrong. That's very, very wrong. Why is that wrong?
Well, I can tell you it's wrong for America. It's actually wrong for Australia, too. Here's the most important thing to do when you want to study an industry. First off, don't listen to the people who are trying to make money, right? Because they're going to tell you, well, there's a lot of factors. The internet came along. We had an economic downturn. All these things are factors. The one thing they don't say is that, well, we've been trying to take 30% profit out of this thing. So every dollar that comes in, we take 30 cents and put in our pocket. And so in a period of decline, if things have turned bad if we can only get 25 cents or 15 cents off that dollar. And that's what's happened in America. Most of our – even newspapers that have been closed have been profitable. But they weren't profitable at that old level. And what happened in the United States, it has happened less in Australia. And you may actually dodge some of the worst of this. In the United States, newspapers made so much money for so long that investor groups came in and bought them. They didn't even know what newspapers they owned. They just wanted the profits from them. And as
it happened here in the 80s to some degree, highly leveraged organizations came in to buy up there. And in order to make money, they had to strip out a whole lot of employees. Yes, that happened here.
And that, and in America, it's happened across the country. And what these investors say is, oh, you're only making an 8% profit, which is double what a grocery store makes. No. That's not why we bought a newspaper. And so they start laying off journalists. If they can't lay off enough, they close the place. Well, this reality has kind of swept across the U.S. It's become a very, very serious issue. And a lot of people blame the internet. But when we did our studies, the fascinating thing we found out was that newspaper readership as a percentage of – the number of newspaper readers as a percentage of the overall population – had been in decline in the U.S. since 1950. Advertising on newspapers had been in decline since the late 80s. But it had been these sort of genteel declines, and it had worked because the wealthy people kept reading the papers. And so you could charge the advertisers to reach the wealthy people. But when the wealthy people finally got one of their assistants to show them how to turn on a computer and could then find the ad or whatever on the computer, you were in real trouble. And this is something Australians ought to be conscious of. It is very likely that a point will come where there's going to be a great deal of discussion about whether you can cover metropolitan Sydney. Instead of having 400 or 500 journalists, maybe we could do it with 10, and maybe we just got too many of them. And they'll rationalize. They'll make all sorts of excuses. But the fact
doing more with less is the phrase.
A win-win situation.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is what they're really talking about is how do we still squeeze as much money as we want out of this diminished give you less and still get as much. And one of the things that will protect Australia to an extent, if you're smart, is the ABC, because the ABC is a national journalism brand that is relatively sustained. I'm not saying it because we're on it. I'd say this on Sky, and I've said this to – I had lunch yesterday with a bunch of the editors of the biggest papers in the country. And, I mean, this is just a reality. When you have a BBC, an ABC, something like this that is going to maintain some journalistic quality, hopefully – although they put you on, so God knows what's
what, – God knows what that was thinking yeah. about there.
But if you're going to maintain some level of quality, then that's gonna make it harder to diminish. In America, we don't have an equivalent of the ABC. We don't have a strong national broadcasting. And so it has become a real crisis in the U.S. I know we've been joking a lot, but this is kind of a bummer situation. We have a lot of communities, especially our poorest communities, our most remote communities, that are just no longer being covered. I mean,
so,
neglected.
One of the few media barons, if you like, that actually has an emotional connection to newspapers is Rupert Murdoch.
Yes.
A very controversial figure, obviously, but nonetheless loves – evidently still loves newspapers. His solution, it would seem at the moment, tentatively, is a paywall. And he's trying it with the Times Online at the moment in the UK.
Yeah.
Will that work?
Well, I will tell you this. And I think that, again, when anybody talks to you about some sort of new technological fix, some sort of new, you know, bell and whistle that's going to work, ask yourself what you do as a human being, because we are consumers of news. We use it as citizens. I happen to be a journalist, but I'm also a human being, a citizen. I want information. Well, I go to British websites all the time. I read The Guardian. I read The Independent. I read The Telegraph. I really do. I'm a big consumer of British news, as I am a big consumer of Australian news. I really do. I look a lot at the rest of the world. When he put his paywall up, I just stopped going to The Times.
But if every newspaper website has a paywall?
Well, that's the theory. It's a nice theory. But apparently no one explained to them the idea of cutting and pasting. And because if that was the case, I would go in, copy a bunch of stories, and then paste them into a free site and then sell advertising on my free site. And you're going to say, oh, well, that would be illegal, right? Well, are we really going to set up a situation where we have the government kind of coming into everybody's house to see whether they're cutting and pasting off websites? I mean, what region of China have we become? And the fact of the matter is that what Murdoch is imagining here is a fantasy that says he can control the news. It's really like one of those bad James Bond movies. It goes against the genius of the internet. The genius of the internet is you go on, you see a story, it's interesting, and it's got a link. You go follow the link to someplace else, and it's got no walls. And the other genius is it's free.
So your solution then to this is, in the United States, public funding of media. At what level? Are you talking about subsidizing the existing news organizations?
No, I'm not. I think that any news organization that allowed George Bush to lie us into the war in Iraq – it certainly doesn't deserve a subsidy, and all of our major news media outlets did. So, with all due respect, they gave up the franchise. No, what I'm saying is this: governments in democracies that are serious about having a democratic state should be looking at ways to make it easy for journalists to produce journalism in a variety of different settings from a variety of different perspectives – print, digital, broadcast, whatever vehicle it goes. And some of this may be tax policy shifts. In the Scandinavian countries, they allow you to deduct from your taxes your subscriptions to newspapers and magazines and even now to websites. So effectively, the government comes in and does a great deal of support. That deduction, you know, it means that you can – you know, sustain media you like. But the government doesn't decide who gets the subsidy. I, as a citizen, decide what I'm going to read, and then I just take it off my taxes. That's a way that government can come in and effectively subsidize journalism without the heavy hand of government coming down and deciding who wins.
Tax breaks. It's a very American solution to this.
Right, yeah, we're all about you know, but those tax breaks, I know this is probably something that has never been said by Tony Abbott. Tax breaks actually cost money. Right. I mean, when you cut taxes for some people, you got to get the money from someplace else. So there is an element of government subsidy. But when I talk about the government coming in to make sure that journalism can continue to survive, it isn't that, you know, Joe Stalin sits there and decides who gets the grant of money. I want to create very freewheeling, very open ways where citizens can consume media from a lot of different places and support it, with maybe the government helping out, maybe new ownership models. I think the ABC should be expanded in a whole bunch of ways. But the ABC, I think, has been very slow to do sufficient digital. And there should be a huge digital build-out, particularly in rural areas and underserved areas, where the ABC might be hiring a lot of journalists to cover an area that, you know, yes, it's unprofitable, but it is something that needs to be done.
That is actually taking place as we speak with the ABC's resources, such as they are. Just finally, you mentioned before we went on air that you began working as a journalist at the age of 11.
Yeah.
11.
Yeah, I lived in a little tiny town in what would be the equivalent of the Outback, and it was in Union Grove, Wisconsin. And I liked newspapers. I actually collected newspapers when I was a kid. When family friends would go on a trip, they'd bring me back a newspaper. And so I just loved them. And I loved politics and that. So when I was 11, I rode my bike down the main street in Union Grove, and I went to the Union Grove Sun. A guy who ran it was a guy named Carl Kruger, who was the editor, publisher, reporter, photographer, printer, linotype operator, and janitor. He was the only employee. He had one woman who came in and helped a little bit with a couple of things. And I said, I've read our Constitution. I've read the Bill of Rights. I've read Tom Paine. I've looked at Woodward and Bernstein. I know that a free press underpins everything that's good about democracy. And I did say these things. And then I said, and I'm reporting for duty.
At 11.
Yeah, at 11. And Carl, I tell you what a small town it is, a town of 970 people. Carl Kruger said, you're hired. I'll give you $5 a story and $1 per picture that turns out. Well, I thought, this is fabulous, you know. So I rode off on my bike in Wisconsin, which actually gets to 30 below centigrade sometimes. You know, sometimes I didn't ride the bike. And bundled up, going out, covering my stories. And a year after I started doing this, through the dumb luck of our political process, we have primaries in the U.S. where candidates have to campaign in different states. The former vice president of the United States, Hubert Humphrey, who had been the Democratic nominee for president. He's a guy who defined our Civil Rights Act, incredible figure. Came to Union Grove, and he let it be known after his speech that he's willing to meet with the local media. And I think to his shock, there was no local media but me. I got on his campaign bus with my 20 questions, asked him all the questions, took my Polaroid picture, took the better part of an hour, the poor man. I realized in hindsight that it was very possibly the high point of my journalistic career, and at the exact same time, the low point of his political career.
That's a wonderful story. I'd love to have you come back on again, John. This has been such good fun. And I feel there's your whole life story, which we've not even covered today. Just this been fascinating talking to you about the future of media in the United States. It's been an absolute hoot. Thank you so much, sir.
I'm honored to be with you. It's been a great pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.